This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Saxo Market Call. It is Friday, 14th of April, 2023, when we're recording this on the topic of generative AI. This is part two of a two-part podcast. The first part, recorded by Peter Garnery and myself, is there on April 6th. If you want to scroll back in the podcast list, you can find that episode there. With this episode, we are very happy to have Emil Saro, head of AI with Droids Agency, with us in the studio, somebody who's working a lot more deeply with AI than either Peter or I, of course. So welcome, Emil, to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Great. And just to start off, so people know where you're coming from, your experience and what it is you do day to day. So give us a brief background on how you ended up in the AI space and what you do with Droids Agency.
So I've been studying a master in physics and nanotechnology. And after that, I decided to go into the consulting business. And by coincidence, I ended up working with machine learning from the beginning, first as a consultant for many years and starting small AI projects up, helping small solutions here and there. And as you guys talked about in the last podcast, it was an interesting time around 2015 and 16, where we had this predictive modeling or supervised learning, and there was a lot of use cases. So I've seen this field evolve, and where we are now is super interesting because it feels like something is taking off that we have not seen before.
Right. Now, one of those things that has really, I think, made this whole AI space splash into the popular attention and it's taking up so much of our bandwidth is the advent of ChatGPT, which I guess is sort of a front end, is it not, to the actual AI itself, which is the GPT-4 behind it. So how big a deal is this relative to what we had a year ago when the average person, including myself, was not really that tuned into the space?
So technology-wise, it's not a very big step, but what's the big step is the publication and the availability for everybody. What is interesting is that a year ago, we could all, in principle, make a subscription at OpenAI for GPT-3, which is actually a stronger model than ChatGPT, but nobody did this because it was not in the public consciousness. So the big thing that has happened now is the adaptability and that it's on everybody's lips. The technology has been evolving since summer of 2017, where Google released a paper called Attention is All You Need or something like that. And that started the whole evolution around transformers, which kind of cracked this nut about how to make the computer understand natural languages, which has been something people have been struggling with for 70 years. And this technology is kind of, you can make a lot of tweaks and make it better and improve the code. But in the end, it's about putting more data in it and putting more computer power into it. And that has been going on steadily since 2017. And every time somebody, be it Google or OpenAI or somebody else, tried, let's put a larger computer, let's give it a larger data set, it became more and more capable. And so if you are interested in this field, 1 or 2 or 3 years ago, you knew that we were able to do this, but very few of us had it between our hands. And so all of those use cases that we see popping up now, people using it as an advisor to invest or make a homepage. In principle, we could all have done this in April 2022 by calling the OpenAI API for not very much money, but none of us did it, right? So there's some interesting story about adapting technology there.
Yeah, and I think it is those natural language. I think we talked a little bit about that, Peter, in part one of the podcast. It's the remarkable ability for it to understand what you're saying and what it produces when you ask it a question. You know, say, compose me a good essay on why I should invest X percentage of my money in bonds or something. It gives you a very well-written, nice, natural language answer to that question.
It was actually funny because we've just had this banking crisis, and I think Steen, he prompted the GPT system with explain to me the side effects, negative side effects of held to maturity bonds, which was a very specific concept that was part of the reason why Silicon Valley Bank failed as a bank, and it actually came back with a pretty lengthy description covering all the angles. And as I said, okay, I could have spent hours trying to research and writing this, and it did it so in like 20 seconds or so. So Very interesting. So what you're saying, Emil, is it very much feels like right now we are in a race where it's all about scale. I mean, just applying more computer power and more data, and then it becomes better. Or are we already at a limit? Or I mean,
no. This is interesting in that sense that, for example, if you build a car and you want it to drive fast, you can put a larger motor on it and it will drive faster. But at some point, it doesn't make any sense to put a larger motor. There's probably something about weight, some other constraints. And so one would assume that at some point those large language models was like, okay, we don't need more computing power, but we have not at all hit this limit. As long as you keep adding computer power and also at the same time feeding it more data, they keep become better and better at almost every task, if not every task. So we are in a paradigm where more is more, which is very interesting because somehow it's a bit dumb that all you need to do to make a new cool research paper or comment in news articles, that's just to use more money on computer power and gain more data. But of course, what OpenAI is doing is also making a lot of small tweaks, which definitely also help. But more data, more computer power, that's the way to go.
But do we have more data if we've essentially fed the entire internet? As far as I understand, on what GPT-4 has learned from, it's essentially the entire accessible internet.
A lot of people ask those questions, and it's hard to answer because famously OpenAI is very closed about the data and the computer power used for GPT-4. But I have a strong idea that there's lots of more data. And there's also many ways to curate the data that you put in so it's a higher quality. And okay, even if we had all the data in the West, which I definitely don't think we have, then what about all the data in India and China, which is in some way definitely also usable? We will hit the limit at some point, and that will also give us, then we can talk about what are we going to do from there on. But now we have not hit that point, I don't think so.
I was wondering, is this because of it, all the compute power it takes, and there are only a couple of companies in the world working on this. So you have OpenAI, you have Meta has their research lab, Baidu has their research lab, and then Google, and both have their own, and then they have DeepMind, which is the most special subsidiary of Alphabet or Google. I'm just wondering, is this a technology where it will end up in maybe only one or two companies in the world? Or, I mean, what are the prospects of this?
That's a very good question. And this paradigm that more is more, and the largest and most expensive model right now would in very many cases be the best at any task. So even if you make a smaller model that's specialized in one task, in many situations it would be beat by the stupid but bigger model in your sense. That would argue for that we would end with a very few very large models. But however, there is also the use case that maybe you don't want to share your data, maybe you don't want to pay the large company, so maybe you can make your own small model in your own company that is good enough for the task.
On that same point, so it's a very interesting point because on the past podcast as well, we showed some graphic that showed all of these startups and different individual applications for generative AI, creating new content or whether it's text, creating photorealistic images or even art. And in the future, they think, of course, because of the difficulty of computing it, the 3D images and video games, et cetera, down the line. So all these startups are specializing in that area, but you're saying potentially the really big but so-called dumb AI might. In other words, are these venture areas, do you think they'll find success in being able to specialize in something highly specific, a voice synthesis or just being able to create totally photorealistic images, et cetera?
Yeah, I think there will always be room for specialization. First of all, because you might have access to training data that the big model does not have. Mm-hmm. So maybe the big model is more clever in the general sense, but because you have carefully curated your own data set that solves exactly that problem, then you can actually make a model that's better in that field. Also, you can use these large language models in different ways. You can use it as we use ChatGPT when you open a prompt and you ask it something. And there's a lot of use cases already as it is here. For example, idea generating or answering a question. But I think most of the use cases is going to take this model and carry it into a context. And then if you want to make your own new specialized startup, then your value proposition is the whole infrastructure around this language model. So that's would be what makes you successful, is that you facilitate to draw all that out of it.
Yeah, and that leads me to one question. So I don't remember if we talked about it over the phone, Emil, but Citadel, which is one of the most prolific hedge funds and financials, you know, service market maker in the U.S., located out of Chicago. They are very close to sign the first enterprise solution with OpenAI, and I wonder what does that actually mean? I was thinking, because, and you said something that just poked my mind. Could they create? Could OpenAI actually help them, consult them, building a model based on all the available information that Citadel has on in their trades, their, you know, their back office, all the things they have. So I'm just playing along here. Okay, so you have, and then you train this local model for all Citadel's own data, and then you could say, okay, if I sit in sales or operation, give me my largest counterpart within the last 2 days, or you can prompt it, whatever. Questions. I mean, could that also be a future?
They definitely could, and they definitely will. And one thing that's not talked so much about, in my opinion, is that OpenAI, through their commercial API, actually facilitates the possibility for you to train your own GPT-3 model. I've not seen if you can do it with GPT-4, but you can take your own data, give it to the model, and then you will have your own twin brother of GPT-3 that's specialized on your data. And that's actually a very cool feature that they offer.
Very cool feature. I actually want to take that as a cue and then jump into, I think, sort of one of the points we want to talk about. And this is the different phases. We touched on it, John, in our part one. And I make this comparison with, you know, the iPhone. So when the iPhone came out in 2007, it was the initial technology. There was hype around it. And the initial, you know, from an investor point of view, you could invest in Apple stocks. But then that was just the first phase. And then the second phase became the whole app ecosystem. And I have a little bit of sense that it's a little bit the same with this technology, that you have the core technology. And John and I would say, okay, how do you actually play this? Okay, you can invest in NVIDIA or in AMD. That seems like the most natural way to get exposure. But then as we go ahead from here, there will be a whole AI content-based economy around this technology. I don't know how you see it, and or is this, and because you sit also on the implementation side, so I guess you have some ideas about this.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be a whole ecosystem about it. And that was also what I tried to say before, that this idea of taking the GPT model and put it in your own context, maybe solving a task that you had another computer system doing before, but now the GPT model will do the same, just better. People are going to use it in all kinds of production lines. And I think that's going to see a greatly growth in use cases. And there's so many fields where this is going to be important. Also, in OpenAI, together with other people, has released a paper called GPTs, where they investigate themselves, like, what is the impact of the world that GPT is going to have? And as always, you have to take it with a grain of salt when the ones who make the model tell you about how it's going to be used. But their point is, for one, that there is a lot of use cases where you can use it out of the box, where it will change, I think it's like 50% of the US work tasks that people work with on a daily basis by 20%. So it's going to have a lot of impact on 50% of the daily tasks. But if you combine it with existing technology to create greater systems, then it would going to impact 90%, I think it was, of all the workforce tasks. So there's kind of a gap between how can you use it just by going to the homepage, openai.com, and what can you do with it when it gets integrated into existing systems.
And this is where I really want to go with the conversation, because John and I, we started with, you know, a basic overview, and we talked a little bit about the investment landscape for AI. But the reason why we also have you here, Emil, is to talk about, you know, there's this great hope that we have had this dilemma in the Western world, essentially the global economy, but especially in the Western world. We have aging societies. We have had what is called a productivity paradox. So we have had very low productivity for a couple of decades. And there's great hope that this can maybe accelerate or enabler of...
Sorry, low productivity or low productivity growth?
Yeah, sorry, low productivity growth.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it's semantics, but it's important. So the whole point is that we for an economy to grow, it has to be productive, and it seems like that might be a lot of low hanging fruits. And I'm just wanted to tell us a little bit about what are you hearing from your customers, and also the way you look at the technology. Where can we see this technology be implemented, and where will it generate a lot of efficiency and maybe remove the need for human input or labor?
Well, there's always the question about where will it displace the humans and where will it make the humans more productive? And in most cases, I see that it makes humans more productive, which you can argue also will displace some humans at some point. But the most one-to-one use case that I see everybody already using it for is coding assistant. You covered that in last episode, but it's just, especially GPT-4, it's amazingly capable of helping you write computer codes. And we've seen so many examples on social media with people who don't know how to code can make their own computer games or make their own Chrome extensions. And it just works great for this. And this is one of the out-of-the-box use cases. Open your open AI subscription and make it help you code. And that's already working, right? Another place where it's working brilliantly is translations, right? Like, and also copywriting and stuff like that. Like also stuff like if you're a PR manager and you want to put make so many posts out of the box, you can just say, I want to write a post that promotes my watch company. And it has to be a post about sustainability and has to focus on Copenhagen. And it will write a brilliant five lines PR post that you might have used an hour to think about. So there's journalism is also a place where it will not substitute journalists, but it can help doing a lot of those things. So in general, everywhere place where you have people using time to formulate text, it can help there. And I would not want to be in a position where my daily job was to translating right now, because I mean, sure, if I was translating novels, I don't think GPT is gonna replace that. But if you're translating small snippets of text and getting paid hourly for that, GPT is just so capable of doing that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think Bloomberg already employs some AI in some of its articles that are often not very interesting to read. Stocks fluctuate as oil drops or something like that. But yeah, it's because it's just taking the basic market movements and composing a basic article from that. But interesting to hear they can, and I agree that the natural language ability is amazing, but that it can even somehow come up with something that has a little bit of flair, or you know, in terms of marketing type of flair and the way it communicates if you ask it to do that.
It's very creative for doing those things. And also this technology, I mean, when we talk about this technology, it's actually a disclaimer I wanted to make from the beginning. You can have different approaches to it, and many people have. You can be the optimistic person talking about how this technology is going to revolutionize the world and it's going to change everything. You can have the pessimistic approach, and that comes in different variants. You can talk about the computers taking over the world. You can talking about it changing our social dynamics. And you can also talk about all the holes and where it's not sufficiently good enough. And you have to choose some kind of approach, even though they're all valid. We need to talk about ethics, and we need to talk about that we should not rely too much on it. But I think this technology seems so revolutionary that our job right now, at least in this context, is to see the use cases, the possibilities, because there's definitely going to be a lot of those, even though there are also a lot of holes that you can fall down in and use it wrong. I think everybody will agree that this is going to make big changes.
Yeah, I was thinking, I mean, when we started the whole app economy with social media, you know, over the past 10 years, it was all driven by an optimism, enthusiasm, and of course, commercial value. And then over time, we of course have seen endless of data showing that, you know, social media has side effects as well, and et cetera, et cetera. And now we're trying to fix that. And I could easily see the same thing here, but we just power on for 10 years. And then along the way, you know, surely bad things will pop up here and there, and then we'll address it. And I actually, as I said to you, John, the other day, there was this very weird op-ed, I think, in the Financial Times with a guy that was working in the AI industry, and he refers back to a conversation he had in a London apartment with some of the AI researchers from DeepMind and some of the other firms in the local community there, and he writes about how he got home that night frustrated that he had this feeling that okay, we are only a small circle of people going to decide and could decide where the humankind is moving towards, and he was talking about that there should be some democratic oversight and et cetera. And I said to John, I mean, when has technology ever been democratic? I mean, when Guggenheim back in the days invented the printing press, it was not like he was walking around. Oh, sorry, Gutenberg. It was not like he was walking around in the city and, you know, what do you think about this? I mean, he just did the technology and it just evolved on itself. And I think we cannot stop this. It's impossible, I guess.
Yeah. But I came to think about I think it was in 1899 that there was the Tsar of Russia. He made the first peace conference of Hague. And one of his very serious proposals was that, okay, so we agree that the grenades and torpedoes and machine guns are sophisticated enough. So let's just not develop this technology anymore. And it was actually an honest effort in the best of humankind, maybe also a bit motivated that Russia was a bit behind France and England and everyone else in that weapon race. But still, people actually fought it as an idea that maybe we can just stop technology from evolving here. But of course, as we all know, that didn't help. And it rhymes a bit with Elon Musk's effort to let's just have a half-year pause on the invention of this. But I don't believe that we can stop technology. And there's also a good point in that if we make a stop, then when we press the power button on it again, it will hit us as a wall, because then the technology difference from one day to another will be even harder. So maybe it's a good thing. It's not for me to judge that OpenAI has been so open about it, because then we have time to adapt for the technology evolution that's going on anyway.
Yeah, and actually that brings me to the conversation we had at lunch before we started recording the podcast, and talking about what the system can produce in terms of credible text, credible stories about this, that, and the other. We've seen how the end of sort of mass media, where there were just a handful of guardians of the public, sort of disseminated in the public as the truth or the news, as part of social media is part of that whole issue. You just sort of retweet things or send along things and share things. You don't even know where they came from. And the proliferation potential of this type of news, choose your own reality. You just say, oh, I want this to take this story and feed it into ChatGPT, but I want to pretend that it actually came from this source, or that this is actually what happened. And it sounds credible. And then that gets shared by a Trump voter or by a non-Trump voter, by a Democrat. And so we can't trust any information we see anymore. So we've talked a little bit about this and how it would be possible is one thing, but in principle, the idea that bringing back trust could be somehow achieved via blockchain. Do you have any sort of image or vision of how that could work, either you, Peter, or Emil, on how we could use blockchain to sort of increase trust in an AI-dominated world?
Yeah, so in the AI-dominated world where you can fake information, be it the photos or videos or voice, then we have to revert back to something that we have used for a long time, which is trusted sources. And trusted sources could be newspapers, or it could be people's, or it could be blockchain, because the basic component of blockchain is that you don't need a trusted source that's dependent on one instance, that the blockchain is the trusted source. So it's an idea that it might be something that we see more going on forwards, that you have the blockchain that helps verify information, that help verify that this tweet actually came from this person, or maybe even more important, this speech or this video is verified by President Joe Biden. So you can see that it's actually authentic. I think that being able to fake information, then we have to rely more on trusted sources, and blockchain might play a role in that going forwards.
I think that's it's a very fascinating discussion, this whole concept about trust, because it is really the glue, I think, in a global information network, that you can actually trust information.
And it's at the very center of the political dysfunction, especially in the U.S., between, there's this side and that side, and lots based on, again, what sources are you choosing to build your picture of reality? And it's understandable in many cases from both sides why these things are happening, but you have to have some kind of universally agreed what is reality.
Yeah, well, and that's a very philosophical discussion. We talked about this before. I mean, reality is multidimensional, I guess, because the way humans see reality is very different from what a bear or a bee sees the reality, because they have different sensor systems. But another question, which I find very interesting, is the potential limitations, because we always, I like to, when we talk about technology, we have been living in a world for 15 years with abundance of cheap energy, and this, we have been taught this idea that technology scales, it's almost unlimited, because that is what we have experienced, and there have been great profits and incredible share price performance by a lot of the technology companies. But the question is, I mean, the whole digital world still sits on a physical world. We have physical data centers, they run on electricity, it has to be produced in the physical world. There is just, as John and I often talk about it, so there are two potential constraints. So one is on the semiconductor, on the chip side. Are there any constraints there? And you can maybe talk about that. And what about the parallelization? Can we just continue to expand compute power indefinitely? And then there's the whole energy aspect, because right now we're doing electrification, a green transformation of our society, and
imagine everyone's pinging AI systems throughout their day to do their work. Yeah. It's the entire world doing it, not just a few people that are curious on ChatGPT.
While installing a heat pump and buying two Teslas, so you're quadrupling your electricity consumption as a household. So there's a computing side limitation, and then a little bit of maybe on the electricity constraint. Maybe I don't know because I guess that's one of the raw input costs for a system is how much power does it use.
Indeed, and nowadays, like, computing power just equals money. It's just a 1-to-1 relation. And there is also another resource that's just the rare earth minerals and everything else that we use to use the computer chips and make the batteries for our Teslas. But I think that the technology has a way of, when there's demand, to solve those kind of problems. So I don't think that we will run out of computer chips, because even though they use a lot of power, it's not like crazy amount of power. And I mean, there is still a lot of ways to generate energy. So I don't think that's going to be the boundary right now. And I also think that already the capabilities we have from GPT-4 is strong enough to generate such a revolution in use cases and use productivity, however you want to define it. So I think that this explosion is going to happen regardless of whether we can generate enough power, because what we're seeing right now is fundamentally that what we've been waiting for, or some people have been waiting for since the 50s, is that we have some computers that can really be creative. And it also puts us human maybe in an existentialistic situation, thinking about, wow, we thought we were so special that we were the only ones who could write a poem. Some people definitely say that GPT-4 cannot write a real poem. But if you prompt it 200 times, it will make a nice poem one of the times.
And maybe ChatGPT-5 can, if ChatGPT-4 can't.
Right? Exactly. So at some point, we're going to be faced with this existentialistic thought about, wow, what is so special about us humans? And this combined with all the new use cases, I think that's going to be it's going to be a growth in our daily task and our way of experience the world being changed a lot in the next 20 years.
Well, fortunately, AI won't be able to enjoy the taste of chocolate or beer the way we humans can. That's one thing it probably never will be able to do. And we may cut out this next segment. I just had the thought to bring this up, and we can talk about it. But there's a, you know, a school of, or a part of AI that is seeking this, not just generative AI, which is sort of learning from the body of human knowledge and trying to create something, but also this search that some are doing for artificial general intelligence. It's a very different beast. You're talking about something that can sort of be intelligent in its own right, and so maybe quickly gain superhuman intelligence. And some have fears that this will mean, you know, within months or years, the end of the world, because it'll automatically just take over and kill everyone. Do you have any thoughts in this space? I mean, you must have some thoughts on artificial general intelligence as somebody that's active in the AI sphere.
Yeah, I don't think this is general intelligence that we're seeing now. And I think, looking at the transformer technology, it's such a simple algorithm. Of course, it's not something that you write quickly, but the whole thing about attention and how it's trained, it's just so simple and so rudimentary that I would expect it to be more complex for it to achieve general intelligence. But there's also a whole other school that just says, yeah, put more data, put more machine learning, compute at it, and then it will be general in intelligence. I do, however, believe that given enough data and given enough compute power, it will be able to simulate all tasks that we humans do. It's just about scaling. But I don't think that it's real general intelligence. But it will be able, GPT-5 or 6 or 7 will be able to be your perfect personal assistant that can help you with any task, reminding you have to go to this meeting, or saying, hey, you didn't respond to this email, but I think it would be appropriate to write this, given that the recipient has this in this situation, and help you with all tasks. But I think
digital tasks.
Digital.
This is actually really, can I stop you there? Because that's a really interesting idea you bring up. So a personal assistant that's AI that is somehow almost like your, maybe even your heart levels are plugged into it. So it's learning based on a data set that is you. So Emil Sarau has his AI assistant, originally, of course, based on a general one, but specific to all your data you're feeding into it. And so I hadn't thought about that. So sort of like a person or an AI world of one.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's totally going to happen, I think. Yeah. Maybe not within 2 years, but we're going to have those assistants. And even Microsoft is apparently at some point launching what they call Copilot 365 or whatever. And it's going to be the start of that, right? Helping you write in your own language when you're writing something in Word or formulating an email or making a PowerPoint show in your own style. And when this also gets coupled up to your calendar and your social media interactions, if you wanted to, it could be a very, very efficient personal assistant when it comes to GPT-6 or whatever it takes.
Wow.
Maybe, what are you actually using GPT for? What are you using it for? Are you using it to help you write code, or is it are you prompting all sort of interesting things? I mean, I'm just curious, what are you using it for?
Me and the team, we're using it for writing code. And I'm experimenting also because I like this technology with it to answer my emails. And I find it that...
No, that's cheating.
Yeah, exactly. but out of the box, you cannot use it to answer emails because it doesn't have all your context. So what I have is I have different pieces of text that I copy paste into it to provide a context. It says like, hello, I'm Emil Sao, I work for this community rights agency. Here's an example of how I normally formulate myself. And we have a consultancy project, and then I have described what project this is about. And when I have copy pasted into it, then I say, here is an email from a customer. Please answer the email. And I want these points. So actually it's maybe 1.5 page of pretext before I even ask it the question. And when I do that, then I can actually make it make very nice drafts. And sometimes, depending on what mood you're in, we all know you can have a writing blockade. You don't even know where to start. And making GPT write 12 sentences and you just need to correct it. Sometimes if it's late on the day or early on the day, it can really be helpful. And for me, that's interesting. And it also underlines the thing that maybe some use cases is a bit difficult to use GPT out of the box, just going into the terminal. But when this get integrated into Microsoft Outlook, I think it will be very strong.
That's fascinating because, yeah, a lot of people, and me in the start as well, when you interact with ChatGPT, you're just sort of asking a question or pulling some information out of it. But actually just feeding it those little sets of data to learn a little bit extra for context and then actually creating some new generative AI output from that.
Many people would object that, wow, you're giving all your personal data to OpenAI. And I just want to make a little note about that, that's exactly what we're doing when we are using WhatsApp and Facebook. And they're also just like, at least if you're paying the $20 a month, ChatGPT is promising not to use my data. Facebook is promising not to use my data when I talk personal stuff with my friends. So in my opinion, this is not very much different.
I don't know, John. I mean, maybe we're getting to the end of this this conversation. This is always the toughest questions, the last ones, right? And maybe also so fun. So, you know, the world is very difficult to predict, and especially the future. But if I forced you to try to come up with, an idea of what your thoughts are, where are we in 5 years from now? And I know it's very hard because the developments are going very fast at the moment. But
why limit yourself to 5 years, though, Peter? How about 5 years? But yes, 5 years is very interesting. But what about 5 years and maybe 15, 20 years?
Yeah, but that's because after 5 years, and maybe we could invite Emil back into the studio, and we could we could hold him up on the prediction. No, but I was just—it's just 5 years. It's within reach, and it's something we can imagine. I think 50 years into the future, we also thought we were going to have flying cars, etc. But in 5 years, what do you imagine? What would the world look like with this technology, do you think?
I would like to compare it to the appearance of social media that at least transformed journalism and advertisement. And suddenly it was not about making advertisement in buses or in billboards on the street. It was about making advertisement on social media. So we have a lot of working fields where everything just got turned upside down. And we're going to see something similar going on here. We're going to see everybody who is living about making content in the form of writing and also images, they are going to amazingly use those tools in their everyday work all the time. And so they're going to be more productive, and we're also going to see less people working in content creating. And then there's also places like law, which is also very, very big businesses. And of course, we're not going to get rid of everybody working with law, but a big law company will use so much of their time making a tedious task like looking through 200 pages, looking for every time where a transaction has taken place. Like those kind of tasks will be brilliant for making large language models, solving them. So I think that the easy task that takes a lot of time, that's with reading and producing text, they will be exchanged with computers, and then we will have people at the top working with the broader lines. So at law, at the journalism, social media, PR, advertisement, customer support also. And I think, was it 15 or 50 years? That was the other question.
I would just take a stab at something a little bit further down the line. So 5 years, you can kind of be working on something now, I imagine, as somebody that's well forward in the whole AI research and realization space to sort of piece together what 5 years might look like. But even further forward, you know, what does 15, 20 years down the line look
It's like? Funny how when people start talking about this, often the conversation falls down to what we in Danish would call borgerløn. I don't know what the
Oh, yeah, it's universal basic income.
Universal basic income, thank you. Yeah. Because many people are thinking about if what we all do is sitting by our computers, a lot of those tasks are getting replaced by computers. What are we then going to do? We're not going to go out and produce food. Everybody are sowing the fields. So in a longer sense, maybe we'll have to think about how our society is going to work out, where we can't all be artists, or we can't all be on the top steering all the robots. And that's actually kind of dystopic in some sense.
And or it could be really nice in other ways.
Yeah, depending on the choices we make. And then people are also like to talk. And again, these are the things that sounds a bit stupid, just like when you talk about fusion energy, either it's 50 years away or else it will never happen. But it's nice to think about. People are also talking about like a robot CTO or CEO, like that takes all the good decisions and makes everything nice. But that's also kind of scary, right?
On a concluding remark, you talked about fusion. I actually think, to some extent, this GPT-4, and you said, I mean, the immediate gains we'll get within the content generating part of our economy and other things related to it. What I really like about DeepMind, which is what all the efforts they have done on protein folding, we've talked about that as well here in the bank, what it means for the biotechnology industry in the future, etc. But also they have made efforts in plasma physics on fusion reactor designs. And they made this design where they created this model that could control 12 magnets at the same time, where the physicists at these experimental reactors only had one model per magnet, so they were not talking together in a complete system. And this AI system that they built for keeping confining the plasma created plasma shapes that the physicists had never seen before. And that is really what intrigues me about AI, if it somehow can enable scientific discoveries at a pace we have not seen before in the physical world. Because think about it, if the AI could help us accelerate an intelligent fusion design and we could get that online, I mean, that would solve a lot of problems on energy and pollution and what have we.
Which it definitely can, and that's also going to make a lot of accelerations. And what is also scary is that when we start getting very useful results, but we don't understand how it did it, right? It's kind of the same thing that when OpenAI makes a new GPT model, it's like a black box coming out of it, and then they are like, wow, it can actually write pretty good Danish because we didn't train it on Danish data. So we make something in a black box, and afterward we found out the capabilities. So normally in the engineering world, when you make a new tokamak chamber, you know exactly why it's working because that was your initial thought. Or if you don't know it and something happened by accident, you will find out. But what about when we reach that point where you get results and you don't understand why, because it was the AI that made it for it, just like the new patterns in the tokamak chamber that you're talking about. It's nice for the progress, but it's also a bit scary, right?
It is a bit scary.
We don't want to end on it's a bit scary, but maybe we have to. I think that's been a really great conversation. I think it's both scary, very interesting, that goes without saying, and a fascinating future that awaits us. It feels like this is a big wave that is washing over us, and a transformation of our certainly our daily and professional lives, and maybe across the board for humanity as well. But Emil Sarro, thank you so much for joining us and for enlightening us on this whole AI space. And I hope we get a chance to talk in the future.
Sure.
For now, that concludes part two of this special edition podcast. Thanks for joining, and we hope to do future special editions in the future, so stay tuned for those.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.